number you have dialed has been changed. The new number is...
Welcome to The Stuart Knight Show, where interesting, intriguing, and exciting people engage in unscripted exchanges of ideas, stories, and perspectives. It's not an interview. It's a powerful conversation.
Okay, everybody, I have got Joanne Liebird, my very good friend, on the phone. And ironically, we were already having a conversation, and I messed up the recording. So, Joanne, it's going to be weird for me to say welcome to the show, because I've already said that to you three times.
Hello, podcast world.
for the third time, right?
Yes.
my apologies for that. Well, you know,
you
and I were having an enjoyable conversation talking about, you know, the people that we live with and on this planet of ours, and how people are continuously, you know, avoiding any type of negative interaction with each other. And I was telling you about this guy who I had left a note for upstairs, and when I pointed out, you know, that he had been breaking glass and on my balcony, you'd think that you'd come running down and you'd be like, "Oh my God, I cannot believe I did that."
Right.
And he just didn't even respond.
Really?
And I thought to myself, you know, we are going to see each other again. Like, it's eventually going to happen. We're going to bump into each other in an elevator. It's a small building. And aren't you going to feel extra odd or more awkward in that moment when you look at me and we're like, "Hey, how's it going? Remember the note?" Yeah.
It's so easy, too. I'm on the board of directors of my condo building. And the number of noise complaints that we get, where people are like, you know, "The neighbor has done this so many times, and you know, I'm so frustrated." And if you ask them, "Did you ever knock on their door or talk to them?" And no, they just skip that step and go straight to, you know, "I'm going to call the police" and whatnot. And I was like, how hard is it to, a lot of times people don't realize they're making a noise that is disturbing other people.
Absolutely.
And some people are super sensitive and stuff. And if somebody, I shower and play my music loud when I shower.
Yeah.
And I sing. I probably drive people insane. But I don't, nobody has ever knocked on my door. And so I don't know that. But if anybody ever did, that music would go down immediately. But people are so afraid to say sorry and so afraid to reach out to their neighbor.
And this is, you know, and when you had said to me, you know, earlier, and I thought that really, you know, struck home, was how I'm amazed at how quickly people will go from 0 to 60 in a split second. They'll go from, like, you know, you'll see a perfectly normal person driving down the street and somebody cuts them off, or you honk at them, or you whatever, and they look at you like, "What are you talking about?" And you're like, "What? Holy crap, man! Like, you look like a guy that, you know, I can see you're wearing a suit. You're driving a nice car.
Right.
2 seconds ago, I noticed you were having a nice conversation with your passenger. If you have a gun right now, you would blow my brains out. And all I did was give you a little honk as a way of saying, 'Hey, you're coming into my lane.'"
Exactly. I was a passenger in a car many years ago, and we were cut off by this driver, and the guy who was driving my car just went ballistic.
Yeah.
And he rolled down his window, and the other guy rolled down his window, and I was like, "Oh gosh, it's going to be awful." And the other guy's like, "I'm really sorry. I didn't mean to do that. I totally didn't see you coming." And it diffused the situation so instantly. And my friend rolled up his window. He's like, "I feel really badly now." he was ready to, like he'd been cursing in the car.
Yeah.
Was totally ready to, like, jump out and tear this guy's throat out.
I have a similar situation, what you just reminded me of, where I was with, you know, our mutual friend Mirza, and him and I were driving in our car, and we came to, I guess it was a stop sign, and we had to kind of inch across the road. It was College Street, and cars were coming, you know, in front of us, and traffic was backed up pretty badly. So I guess something must have just happened in front of us. So we're sitting there, and we can't really get anywhere, and the cars are kind of going in front of us really, really slowly, so we can see people perfectly. And this one guy, his fists are clenched around the steering wheel, and he is screaming at the car in front of him like his head is literally going to pop off the shoulders, right? It was so comical that Mirza and I just, we didn't even have to say anything to each other. I think one of us may have said, look at that guy. And
right.
And he was now stopped kind of in front of us. So it was like a TV show watching it. And we started laughing so hard, like that uncontrollable gut laughter. Like we're both banging our hands on the dashboard. It's so funny.
Right.
While we're laughing, the guy who is screaming his head off turns his head and looks over at us and sees that we're laughing our heads off at him.
Uh-huh.
And he looks at us and he has a moment of shock. And then he starts laughing.
Oh, that is so great.
Right? And he starts laughing and he must have thought, oh my God, what am I doing? Like, I am so out of control that they're not even looking at me and they're scared. They've moved into just sheer laughter. So, but my ultimate point is that a person who sits in their apartment and day after day takes the noise that their neighbor is putting out there and doesn't say anything, and they're so afraid to interact with somebody to the point where they go to their board and they say, can you come knock on my neighbor's door and ask them to turn their music down? That person is the individual who is in the car who one day loses their top because they're holding it all in.
For sure. I also think that, you know, there's power in I'm sorry or in just apology in general. Like,
oh God, yeah.
And I was raised by an amazing mother who you've met, but she never said sorry for anything. And so I never learned how to say sorry from like growing up. It was weird. I mean, I would never, you know, hit somebody in the face and then not apologize or anything like that.
Sure.
But sorry was a really difficult lesson for me. And then I met my best friend when I was 30, and she was so good at facing those really difficult, awkward situations and admitting when she was wrong. And it was an amazing lesson for me. And so I've learned to kind of face those challenges. It's not necessarily an innate thing. Like you need to practice this, just like you need to practice powerful conversation.
Well, you're absolutely right. And it's interesting that you say that, because a lot of people, and I would say most people, walk around this planet and they don't actually think to themselves, do I possess the skill of sorry? Am I good at that? And we ask ourselves, you know, am I good at math? Am I good at being a good mom? Or am I good at my job? We ask ourselves those questions all the time.
Right.
But we don't ask ourselves, you know, two examples of that would be, am I good at saying thank you? And am I good at saying sorry? In fact, I actually wrote an article about this one time where I had a business. I was trying to rent this theater in Toronto for one of our big shows, and the one woman I was dealing with, I mean, I can tell you, I've been an entrepreneur now for 20 years, as you know. I know when someone drops the ball. Like,
right.
I'm not, you know, day one into my business here, and so this woman dropped the ball, and she just wasn't getting back to me. She was wasting my time, and there's all kinds of issues. So I finally got in touch with her manager, and I said, look, you know, it's once again the Canadian friendly message of saying, look, this individual has dropped the ball here, and I'm a client. And the rent for this place, by the way, was $11,000 for the night. It's not like I was going to spend a small amount of money here. So when this manager got back to me, my goodness, the easiest thing for her to have ever done would have been to just say, hey, look, you know what? You're right. Based on the facts you just gave me, we did drop the ball over here, and I'm really sorry. How can I make it up to you?
Right.
Okay. Instead, she sends me this long email. I mean, I'm talking a full-page email of, first of all, I'm sorry that you felt like we dropped the ball. Okay? So that instantly disassociates yourself. You're the one who thinks we did. We didn't actually do it. Right?
And then, so let me say straight out of the gate, you're stupid.
Yeah, exactly. Let's just get this right out of the gate and just let you know, you've just reached the pinnacle of your career.
Right.
Because if you don't have the ability to be able to say sorry to a simple customer, I think you've just reached the highest echelons of management. You just like look at your salary now, add 4% every single year, and that's where you're going to be in 20 years, because you clearly don't put yourself into a position of advancement. And so anyway, oh, it was just on and on and on. It was actually great fodder for a newsletter, because I took this this apology, and I actually embedded it into a newsletter and changed the names and changed the theater names so I would keep the person's privacy. And I went and I said, this is how you do not apologize. And I think you're right. It's an absolutely wonderful gift to be able to say sorry and to say thank you. Thank you is a big one. You know,
right.
How do you say thank you? Like, well, you know, like what would you say are the best ways to say thank you to someone?
I think the unexpected thank yous are amazing because they're, thank you is so often rare that offering it up when people don't expect it is amazing. The simple thank you, just saying yeah. thank you is also great. But then, you know, like little gifts and trinkets, there are myriad ways. I guess each situation calls for a different approach. But just making that effort is what matters.
Yeah, that, you know, and that's the key. And one thing I like what you said there is that every situation has a different, it requires a different approach. Because me thanking you, you know, I know that you're somebody who loves music. So if you've gone out of your way and you've done something for me, I can thank you by buying you a new music CD, and it cost me $15.
Right.
And but for you, that means a lot more than it would for me giving that, let's say, to my mom, who maybe is not as into music. And so when people are going to thank someone, just take 5 seconds to think, what do they like? How can I make them feel special?
Exactly.
But speaking about feeling special, what you just must be feeling pretty special. You just got back from, what was it, a couple of days ago, England?
Yeah, I was in the UK and in Paris. So I was there for a friend's wedding. Mm-hmm. And I was in the UK for a friend's wedding and then popped over to Paris to try and do something about my very sad wardrobe. I'm one of those girls who does not like to shop. And so I let things go and go. And, you know, I put on a jacket or a coat, or last winter I saw a picture of myself from something like 2003 and I was wearing the same coat. It's time to buy a new damn coat. You know, and the few things that I still wear that still get compliments were all purchased on a trip to France. So I decided pop over to France and see if you can do some shopping. I got a few little things, but like I said, I'm a bad shopper, so I didn't get very much.
How awesome is it, eh? I mean, I remember we were texting and we were joking around about this. How cool is it to be able to just pop over to France?
Oh, I know. I say that to my friends all the time because they can not only pop over to France, but to Spain and to Prague and to anywhere.
Yeah.
it's amazing. And, you know, they have all these discount airlines. So not only can they do that, but they can do it for like £39.
Yeah.
And
I think that popping over to France is like the closest thing we'll ever get to time travel.
Yeah.
Right? Because it's you know, you can, I mean, like, you're right, being in London, England, for sure, you can jump on a plane and you can go to Barcelona and come back the same day. But there's something about the fact that going to France from England is a train ride.
Mm-hmm.
And you go under the water, as we both know, and then you come back and you can
super pleasant train ride at that.
It really is.
It's super fast, super pleasant.
Yeah, it's a gorgeous train ride. And so and you pop in and you can go shopping, and then of course you jump on a train and you come back and you have dinner. And even though it's not technically time travel in the sense that, yeah, everyone is still pretty modern, same kind of, a lot, very similar styles and stuff. But France and Paris and London are still so different from each other.
So different, yeah.
You feel like you have gone into another world, or you have maybe gone into another time zone.
It is amazing. Actually, you do go into a different time zone because I look down at my phone, I'm like, wait, what happened to that hour? And then I realize it's an hour difference.
Oh, it's true. I forgot about that.
But yeah, it's amazing. While I was there, though, I've been to England, oh gosh, more times than I can count on both my hands.
Right.
And
which is the maximum amount of counting you can actually do in general, right?
We're going to mention that. but it's so pleasant to have a second city. I feel like London really is my second city. One of those places where you land, and I think for you it's New York.
Yeah.
You land and you just know where things are. You know how to get around. You just have a local feel about you. There, even if you're carrying a suitcase, you look like a local carrying a suitcase.
Yeah.
And I love that. I love having a second city on the other side of the planet. It's amazing.
Well, this is why I'm so confused, and I might offend a few people who are listening to this right now, but it's always been so confusing to me when I think about people who travel, their second city is a resort. You know, it's like, and this is, this is coming from a guy who's a big believer in resorts. I mean, once in a while, yeah, you just need to get, especially for Canadians, mm-hmm. we need to get the hell out of the winter and go sit on a beach for 3 days and that remember that, right?
Turn off our brains.
Yeah.
And enjoy the sun.
Exactly. And, And so for me, you know, you do that once in a while, but I'll meet people who's like, yeah, you know what? We've just got this one resort in Cancun, and we've been 9 times now. And I'm like, okay, so, and like, yeah, we just know where everything is. We like that. I'm like, what do you mean? You know where all the washrooms are, or
right.
I'm going to guess the beach hasn't moved in the last 8 times since you've been there. And so it's not the same as, you know, walking down the streets of London, England, or in Paris or New York and going, okay, I know where I'm going here, and feeling like a local there. It's and I'm not trying to – I know that people go, oh, he's so mean. Just let people just do what they want to do. And I do. My God, I have a hard enough time controlling my own life, let alone controlling anyone else's lives. But at the end of the day, I just want to pick these people up sometimes and go, okay, totally cool. Instead of going to Cancun, though – let's just come with me to New York for one weekend, or come with me to London. Let's just go there and walk around. You're going to have an experience where you push the limits of your mind. You're going to have new ideas. You're going to eat food you've never tried before. You're going to see a fist fight break out in the street. And guess what? That's good, because right. that shows you a part of life that you don't normally see.
I do think that, yeah, like I believe, like, you know, if you love going to Cancun every year, then fine, go to Cancun. But there is really a true benefit to being immersed in a culture. And I don't think that, you know, your on-resort experience really gives you that. Mm-hmm. You know, just seeing what Mexico looks like from between the airport and the resort and back doesn't tell you what Mexico is like.
And yeah.
So, and most people will be like, I don't need to know what Mexico's like, but I really, really believe that everyone should experience another country for more than just 2 weeks or 1 week, but should really get to understand how people live differently from us, especially as Canadians, because our lives are so sweet. Uh-huh. You know, everything is so easy for us. And even comparing us to parts of the States and stuff, like, we are laughing. We have a sense of security and safety and affluence that, you know, somebody in the back waters of Mississippi will never understand or never experience. And I think that we sometimes need to be faced with that head on.
I couldn't agree more. You know, it's funny. I when I hear about some of my fellow Canadians and fellow Westerners as well, I mean, whether you're in the States or you're whether in Europe, and people will talk about how, of course, they're recognizing how lucky we are, and, you know, how we have access to drinking water and to flushable toilets and to education and to healthcare. And when I hear, and I'm in a group of people that are talking about how lucky we are, I sometimes find myself going, yeah, doesn't that suck? Because the reason for me it sucks is that nothing exciting really happens in that kind of environment. I'm not suggesting that I want to live in a world where I don't know if I'm going to make it to the end of the day, or that whether or not there's going to be a bomb that goes off later on. But you got to suggest, or at least I think we have to acknowledge, that for people who do live in those kinds of worlds, every day there must be a certain quote unquote aliveness that they feel that we don't feel here.
Or even a learning. There's learning in adversity. There's learning about compassion or about neighborliness.
Mm-hmm.
And not when, you know, a bomb explodes a kilometer from where you live, which is what happened when I was living in Sri Lanka, you know, and people come together to make sure everyone's okay. And just being in an environment where you know that things are tenuous, and I don't think everybody needs to, you know, you need to live in a war-torn area for 6 months to really feel life. but I do think that, you know, if everything is always humming along tickety-boo, we aren't challenged as people to be the best that we can be.
That's true. It's so true. And, you know, when you talk about the idea of learning, the things that to me are most important to learn are, you know, the big categories of life: family, friendship, community, your partner, your love life, whatever. These are off the top of my head,
mm-hmm.
are 4 major categories that we should learn about in order to be able to really soak up the best parts of life. And so when you are in a situation where, okay, either A, you know, one end of the spectrum, which is you live in an area where bombs do go off, or let's say we pull back from the far end of the spectrum, we say you just live in an area that's just poor. You know, many African countries, for example, where, you know, people every single day, yeah, they're not worried about whether they're going to die, but they are so poor that they do have this unbelievable sense of community that we don't experience here. My brother Calvin, who worked for many years with families and disadvantaged children in Uganda, he would tell me, he said, you know, I would walk through these villages and literally most of the kids don't even have shoes on their feet. And he said, yet... I can tell you with my life on it that these people will laugh more in one day than most Canadians I know laugh in an entire month. You know, and it's because these people are living together, and like we need to come together because I might not have fresh water today, so I have to go to my neighbor's place. Right. I have to interact with my neighbor, or my neighbor comes over to me because their kid has cut themselves. They don't have a Band-Aid, and we might be the one person on the street who actually has one Band-Aid left. And so people, because of their situations, are forced to come together, okay, as a community. So that makes a greater community experience.
And you don't have to wrestle with the bullshit. Like,
yeah.
I recall when I was walking to work in Sri Lanka and stuff, and my area had a whole bunch of kids, and I realized about like 10 months in that I have never seen any of these kids have tantrums, you know? And because like they had nothing. They had, well, next to nothing. And, you know, a pen made the smile like crazy, like this is a great fun toy. And yeah. And I was like, you know, if they lost the pen, that there was no like freaking out, you owe me another kind of reactions, you know. They're just I appreciate what I have, and this is our lives, and our lives are good.
Well, that's why, and I always find that when you meet young children in these types of countries, and you and I have both been fortunate enough to do a lot of travel in our lives, and we have met these kids, and mm-hmm. I'm always amazed that I'll meet a kid who I automatically assume must be, you know, 16 years old, and because of the kind of mentality of the 16-year-old I'm used to, and I'll find out they're like 12.
Right.
And
right.
The maturity, or you meet a 7-year-old who's more mature than a 15-year-old in Canada. And it's because they've already had to work, they've had to appreciate things, as you say, they've been disciplined in a way that where a parent comes across and says, "No, you, that's unacceptable behavior. You're not allowed to act like that."
Mm-hmm.
And those kids, I always love talking to those kids. They're so cool. Like I've had kids who are begging. I remember this not too long ago when I was in Cambodia, and they came up to the table, and the one little boy, he must have been, I don't know, 7. He came up and I was chatting with him a little bit, and he was asking me to buy stuff, and I'm like, no, I'm not going to buy stuff, because I didn't want to. I knew if I'd be attacked if I bought one thing. And then I think I eventually bought something, but he, within, I think, about, I'm not kidding you, maybe in a minute or two, he sat in my lap.
Oh.
He just sat in my lap, and I said, "You want some food?" And he goes, "Yeah, okay." So I prop him up, and he starts eating off of my plate with me. And you tell me a 7-year-old boy would do that in Canada. First of all, they would be, you know, they've already had it driven in their heads that everybody that they don't know is
trying to hurt them.
And I understand the importance of keeping children safe. I get that. But the maturity of this little kid and the trusting of this kid was amazing. And I tell you right now, I genuinely believe that if I was a bad person, that boy wouldn't have come up to my table. He wouldn't have sat on my lap.
I feel there's like an emotional intelligence there?
Absolutely. Or? This kid knew what he was doing. This was not, you know, he understood just by my smile, by my eyes, and he understands because of experience and because of maturity. And, you know, when I see this kid and compared to, oh my God, this kid I saw, I may have mentioned this to you, when I was doing that trek in the Amazon, and there was this one family, well, these two parents who had one child, and this boy was 9 years old, and before leaving the airport, he laid down and had a temper tantrum and cried his eyes out.
Oh, no.
And, you know, and then I find out later that this kid, goes to school with David Beckham's kid. Like, you know, so we know there's money, and for whatever reason, you know, this kid is, I mean, I'd never seen anything like it. Nice people, but they did not know how to parent. And it was no surprise, this kid's going to grow up and be, I mean, I don't want to say this in a mean way, but I think he's going to grow up and be a bit of an idiot.
Right.
You know, and I'm just giving you one example. For 4 days of being with these people, I mean, it was just, he wouldn't eat the food, or every 5 seconds he kept asking if the lodge that we were staying at would give him their Wi-Fi access. There's no Wi-Fi. You're in the Amazon, man. He wants to play with his iPad, and he would complain about everything, and I mean, even more temper tantrums. I'm like, you know how many 9-year-old boys
I know
would just be so excited to be here right now? And you're, oh, anyway, so there really is something to be said about the parenting of these kids. I know that we've gone on a bit of a tangent from, you know, the experiences of travel and how there are probably certain options that will open your eyes to certain things more than others. But that's the one thing my eyes have been really opened up to is just children and how they just seem to be so cool in other countries. And don't get me wrong, I've met cool kids in Canada. I just told a guy friend of mine the other day, I texted him, I said, I just want you to know, I think your kids are really cool. And that's a testament to the effort that him and his wife have made. There's no surprise why certain kids are cool and certain kids are not, because it's your parents that make you cool.
For sure. And I will confess to the podcast world that I am not a kid person. Never have been, never will be. But every time I come across kids that are cool, it fills my heart with joy. And I have to say, most of my friends have really cool kids, and I'm just like, knock on wood, this is great.
Yeah.
I don't mind spending time with you, but they are amazing parents. So
yeah. There's specific things that they've done, you know? And I think probably the biggest thing that I've seen, that makes kids cool are parents that are not afraid to discipline. And that would be, when I say discipline, I'm not talking about, you know, you don't have to smack your child around,
right,
but you do need to let the child.
Set boundaries.
What's that?
Set boundaries.
Set boundaries. Exactly. You have to let these children know that, you know, a friend of mine actually said this to me recently. And when she said this to me, at first it felt, I was like, wow, that's kind of harsh. But when I thought about it more, I thought, oh, you know what? That makes sense. She goes, when my partner and I decided to have kids, and she has two boys, she said, we were very clear with each other. Like, we verbally communicated to each other and said, these children are coming into our lives.
Right.
We are not coming into theirs. And they will understand that they came into mommy and daddy's world, and things are going to be dictated based on mommy and daddy's world.
And have your friends maintain that? Because I mean, that's the attitude that I always espouse, but as somebody who has no kids and probably won't, I wonder if that is, I've always thought like, well, this is the arrogance of somebody with no kids being able to say, oh no, they're not going to affect my life in that way, and they're going to operate under my rules.
Yeah.
But have your friends succeeded in that regard?
150%.
Amazing.
Yeah. They said it, and they've done it, and their kids are cool kids. And all they have to do when the kids are getting out of hand is just turn to them. You know, it's funny. I was in Starbucks the other day, and there was this one little back kind of alcove in this particular Starbucks, and there were these three women who came in, and each one of them had a boy, and I'm sure they probably became friends because their kids go to school together, because all the boys were the exact same age, which would be very coincidental if you were friends before that.
Right.
Anyway, and these three boys were, they're boys. They're doing the exact same thing that I would have done when I was a boy. They were running around this little alcove. But then they started playing hide and seek.
Right.
And then they started actually like hiding underneath people's chairs.
Ah, right.
Okay. And then eventually it was getting out of control. And the three moms were just chatting like it was nothing. Like that was totally acceptable behavior. And then I was just about to say something, and this other guy comes in and he goes, look, it's getting a little excessive now. Right. And then the moms go, oh, yeah, right, absolutely. And, you know, they acted like they didn't know what was going on. And I just thought, this is just bad parenting. You're letting your children get the sense that, you know, any public space is not shared by other people. It's theirs to just do as they will. But that's an opportunity to pull them aside and say, hey, guys, you know what? I understand that, you know, when we're in the basement of our house, you guys can scream and yell and you can play hide and seek, but we're in a public space and there's people trying to do work here. There's people trying to have meetings here. We need to respect that. And they missed an opportunity as opposed to, you know, taking advantage of it.
Yeah. I mean, parents need to teach their kids that sometimes you're going to be bored.
Yeah.
It's just the way it is.
I know, right? And it's funny because as we talk like this, I know that you and I have said, are we just becoming those old people? Are we are we the people that are talking like our parents did? I don't know. I think that this has been a running theme, this type of conversation. I think that for many years, parents have been, or I should say generations, have been talking about, you know, children being misbehaved or discipline being something that seems to be lessening more and more. In our world. I mean, I see this. I mean, when I talk to my brother Calvin, who is a high school teacher, he tells me, I mean, he's been a high school teacher now, I'm going to guess, for like at least 15 years. And even just 15 years ago, when Calvin, what was it? He was in a situation where he said, you know, the way that I could, I could call a parent and they would automatically take my side. And they would be like, yeah, absolutely. If my kid's being a jerk, let me know. I'll give him a talking to, and he can go into school and he'll be different the next day. And Calvin says 15 years later, in just such a short amount of time, I call these parents, and in many cases, their reaction is to tell me why maybe it was my problem.
Yeah, you hear it with people saying that parents are accompanying their kids to job interviews and meetings with the university and stuff like that. Like, I think it's that, I think they're calling it helicopter parenting, but not allowing kids to grow, you know, and to become independent people and learn the hard knocks of life.
Yeah. Yeah. I always, I've always said, you know, if I were to win $1 million today, I would probably give all of it, away I think I'd give it all away to my family, or I'd give it away to charity or something like that. And people have always said, bullshit, you wouldn't do that. And the truth is, the reason I would want to do that is because I like the hard knocks. I like having to, on a daily basis, kind of have to figure it out and have to work on my game or do certain things to be successful.
I think you're crazy.
I know you do. Everyone thinks I'm crazy when I say that. But and who knows? Maybe if I won the lottery, I wouldn't do it. But it's easy for me to say in this position. But I do think that I like, you know, knowing that every single day, the money that I make as a speaker or as an entrepreneur or as an event planner or a producer, I like knowing that it's always comes down to me having to make it happen. And I feel so much more alive in those moments than I would if I was just sitting here at the end of this call knowing I don't have to work for the rest of the day if I don't want to, because I've got $1 million in the bank.
Right,
you know? And I wonder what will happen when I will have $1 million in the bank. You know, I've thought about that. Like, I do well in business, and you kind of do the math and you look down the road and you think, yeah, you know what? It's just a matter of time until you do enough saving and smart investments that you do have a significant amount of money in your bank. And then I thought to myself, you know, what do I do in a situation like that to kind of keep that fire in my belly?
Yeah, I can't see you just sitting around if you had $1 million.
Yeah.
You would always have to be doing something.
That's kind of true. That's kind of true. So, by the way, I want to ask you, so when you went to England, did you go by yourself?
Yes, I did.
So you've done a lot of travel by yourself. How do you feel about that? Like, is that something, because a lot of people wouldn't feel comfortable doing that. Do you feel comfortable doing it?
But I don't enjoy it. I much prefer traveling with people.
Yeah.
Just because, you know, especially if you're going somewhere new, if I see something cool, I want to be able to turn to my friend or my partner and just say, oh God, look at that. That's so neat. Or that reminds me of this place and stuff like that. But when you're doing it on your own, it's kind of boring. But with England, having been there so many times, and I have a lot of friends there, so it's kind of like traveling to people you know instead of traveling with people you know. So
right.
It's enjoyable that way.
Okay. And how was the wedding?
Oh my gosh, so beautiful. I'm such a suck for weddings, it would appear. I'm usually like a really kind of cool, heartless kind of girl, but
yeah, weddings, I disagree.
And I love the pomp and circumstance of a British wedding. Like, you know, women were wearing hats and men were in their morning suits, and it's just lovely. So,
oh, nice. And it's funny because, you know, I'm not sure if you saw that on the news, but we have a new what is it, lieutenant governor? What do they call the person who's
a representative of the Queen?
Yeah, is that lieutenant
governor? Governor general. Lieutenant governor is Ontario.
Oh, okay, right. So the new governor general, and I think it's kind of hilarious, and this is as a person who holds a dual citizenship, that we still have such a tie to England. But, you know, they had a real formal thing where she was brought in on horse and carriage, and then they had like a, you know, however many gun salute to her. They had like, you know, the typical choir singing, and because she's the Queen's representative. It's like, that's the way the English do it, eh?
It's kind of ridiculous because, most of the time the English wouldn't give a poop about what's going on here, certainly,
right.
or with the royal family. I think the obsession with the royals is a much more international thing than it is an England thing.
Right. Do you think that England will, do you think there'll ever come a time when England decides that the monarchy is no longer relevant?
I don't see it happening. I mean, I think that a lot of people feel that it's no longer relevant, but I don't think there is the political will, or will be the political will, to try and oust it.
Right. Yeah.
It's just history. And I think people recognize that it's not important, but it's the royals are kind of soft power, kind of like the BBC. Like, you know, like,
yeah.
They attract the interest of people around the world, which make England interesting to foreigners. Do they do anything that is important? Yeah, maybe a little, but not much.
Right.
But I think the soft power that they exert is invaluable to the country. So.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that that you can be sure of behind closed doors is that the monarchy has probably the number one PR team in town, right? Because I was thinking about this one time. I was thinking, you know, technically speaking, if anyone has any type of real kind of intellect around this, there is no kind of economical argument that you could make. And maybe the tourism, yeah, you could probably make that argument that the tourism dollars have come in because of the monarchy. But I don't know if...
I don't know if that's a strong enough argument.
Yeah, and even then, I mean, it's kind of like that whole thing about people saying, well, if you say that you can't smoke in bars, no one's going to come to bars anymore.
Right.
Well, that clearly was wrong. And so when it comes to, you know, if you take the monarchy out, no one's going to come to England anymore. I think you probably still see a lot of people coming to England for all the other amazing things that England offers.
Right.
So... you know, when it comes, so you can't make the economical argument. You can't really make much of a nationalistic argument. I think that people are, you know, I think that football, soccer, plays a greater role in the nationalistic feel that people have than the monarchy does. If you were to eliminate soccer, that might screw things up on a nationalistic perspective. You're like, oh my God, I'm moving. And so my point is that the monarchy is smart, and behind closed doors, they know they aren't needed in
right.
order for the world for England to survive. But they have a lot of money and power. I'm not sure if you know this, but the monarchy owns 60% of the British coastline.
Wow!
They own 60% of the border of their freaking country, right? And that's just the border. That's not even talking about the interior parts. And then, of course, as we know, I mean, the amount of land that they own in places like Ireland, Northern Ireland, or in Scotland or Wales is a whole other area. So, so I think that behind closed doors, they're like, you know what? We need to create the ultimate distractor. Okay, so. Harry, you're going to go to the orphanage and you're going to feed children today. Prince Charles, you're going to go to be with those, war veterans. And, you know, they send them off to all these different PR campaigns. And every single time you ever see the British monarchy in the news, it's almost always at something that makes you go, oh, they are such nice people.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. They've played it smart to continue to be intriguing and yeah, relevant to the world.
Right, right.
It's very smart. Excellent PR, you're right.
Yeah, we need them. Look at all the good, and that's what people will say. If you ever make the argument about, there shouldn't be a monarchy. Anybody who's for the monarchy, whenever I've had this debate, they always come back and they always say the same thing. They'll say, oh, no, look at all the good they do. And I'm like, or they'll talk about, my favorite is when they'll say, no, Prince Harry and Prince William, they served for the British Army. I'm like, oh, yeah. Like, I'm really sure. They said, okay, guys, we got a special ops team going into Iraq tonight, and there's only going to be 6 of you. It's going to be probably 3 of you will come back. Harry, William, get in on this. I'm pretty sure those guys are not being sent into the most difficult situations.
Right. Right.
And,
just challenging enough to be impressive.
Yeah. Yeah. You get a couple of good shots with them doing the army crawl somewhere. They get a little dirt in their face, get a picture of them shooting a gun. Yeah. Okay. It makes it feel like they're actually part of the army, but anyone down there will tell you, no, these guys are not on the front lines of anything. And so, I don't know. I just feel as if there seems to be, for me, as you know, it's the unfairness that I get all pissed off about. Like, if you've got homeless people in your country, you know what? How about giving up 10% of your coastline? You'll still have 50% of the coastline, right? Give 10% of it up and use that money to help the homeless. Do that, to help new immigrants to your country. I mean, you name it. Do good work with it. And I just think it's so frustrating to see these people going, oh, no, yeah, we're just going to keep it all for ourselves. It's like, seems completely fair.
Yeah, I think it's obviously easy to do good when your life is extremely comfortable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. It's like if you and I gave $10 to some local foundation, people wouldn't be, cheering in the streets for us.
About all the good we do. Yeah.
Yeah, look at, Joanne, she gives out $10. But these guys, if they give out, £1,000 or 10,000 pounds or even £500,000, people go, oh, that's so amazing. It's like, it's really not that amazing when you've got billions and billions of dollars.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And what was it? Like, I don't even know when the year was, but they just started paying taxes, I think, sometime in the last 10, 15 years.
Oh, wow.
Right? And the biggest thing that I always think about that people forget about is that people, at least on some level, have to recognize that if a monarchy is in power, there, on somewhere along the line, somebody in your family killed somebody to get the job.
Can't we say that though?
What's that?
Can't we all say that though about our own families? Family hasn't killed somebody.
Yeah, I guess so, right? But just the only thing is that you and I haven't benefited quite as well from it.
Yeah, exactly.
I was thinking about the idea. I don't know what.
Strategically.
Yeah, right. I've been watching some of these weird, I don't know why I've been into it. I think I've been into it because they're only 20 minutes long. And I just sometimes need a bit of a distraction. But on Netflix, I'll watch one of these like crimes unsolved, cases or murders unsolved. And it gets me really into thinking about this, the whole concept of killing someone and like not wanting to do it, but thinking about, wow, what a weird thing to do, eh?
Yeah, that's an understatement.
Yeah.
I think you really have to give up a little bit of your humanity to be able to do it.
Yeah.
Whether in the lead up to doing it or in the aftermath of doing it, I think it must be an incredibly challenging thing to do unless you're a psychopath and not walk away from it completely scathed.
Right. Yeah.
No, scathed is actually a word.
Yeah. Yeah.
Scathed is, but.
Well, when you say psychopath, it makes me think about the fact that I always think it's funny when people say, yes, this person's putting in a plea of insanity when they're for a murder trial. And I'm thinking, mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure everyone who kills someone is crazy.
Yeah, it's got to be.
Right? Like, even if you find your wife in bed with your best friend and you happen to have a gun in the drawer next to the bed and you pull it out and in that moment you blow the person away, even then you had a moment of insanity.
Definitely, definitely. And is that a valid excuse? I don't know.
Yeah, I know. What about you and I haven't talked about Robin Williams killing himself. What do you think about that?
I mean, it's a tragedy. It's a tragedy, and it's funny because my mother is very on the why would people go and kill themselves?
Yeah,
black and white on these things, and has no patience for that. Like, mm-hmm. It's like if somebody tries to kill themselves, good.
Right.
And I struggle a lot with that. Attitude, because I recognize that in many cases people are struggling with a mental illness that I could not even begin to fathom. And obviously my mother couldn't either. And that was the case with him. I can't relate to getting to that kind of dark place.
Right. Do you think it's a chemical thing in those moments, or do you think it's just years and years and years of Robin Williams or anyone else who does it? And I know there's different reasons for different people, but growing up in a society where, I don't know, like, is it our fault on any level with Robin Williams? I mean, do we all just make the mistake of everyone who's ever met him or anyone who's ever tweeted about him all make the mistake of just saying, oh my God, you're just so great, you're so great, you're so great. And did we never let him be a real human being? And was that just too hard for a person to deal with?
I think it's, I do lean more on the chemical explanation, although I feel for people who don't suffer from clinical depression, but are perhaps more prone to sadness. Mm-hmm. Our society's emphasis on always being happy and look on the bright side and, you know, buck up, the things will get better kind of attitude, it does them a disservice. Like, you know, we always feel guilty if somebody asks, you know, how are you doing today? We always just automatically say, oh, great.
Yeah.
Even though, you know, things are crappy. and occasionally we, with our closer friends or family, we'll be honest, but there is that sheen of everything's got to be fine that we put on for everybody, which is why, you know, all of our Facebook posts are, the vast majority of Facebook posts are, you know, look what I'm doing. My life is so great. It's so cool, blah, 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 because we want to put on the best face because that's what society expects of us.
Yeah. You know, it's funny when I, in my speech, and you've heard me do this, there's a part in there where I talk about going through my own depression. Mm-hmm. And it was a very dark period of my life. And it's amazing to me how often, and this is not just once in a while, I can say almost 9 out of 10 speeches I do, there's a person that comes up to me and they're always that person waiting around and then waiting for everyone else to leave. And then they say, can I just talk with you? Or can I walk out to your car with you? I'm like, yeah, sure. And then they'll say, listen, when you talked about depression today, that was really important for me. And it really meant a lot to me because I go through that. And, you know, it's not something I feel comfortable talking about out loud. And it really was inspiring to see someone who's willing to get up and say it in front of a big group. And if I think to myself, you know, if there's one person who stays behind and who wants to speak to me about that, how many other people just didn't have the courage to stay behind, and how many other audience members are feeling the same way? And then how many people are walking through this planet and not feeling comfortable creating these kinds of conversations because it's so taboo?
It is, absolutely. And I mean, the mental illness movement has done a good job of kind of raising that awareness a bit. But my friend actually, who does suffer from clinical depression, he had posted on Facebook recently that he hates the idea of people characterizing it as a mental illness. He's like, it's not a sickness. It is a chemical imbalance. It's a disorder. It's a disease. Mm-hmm. But it's not just a something that will get cleared up. I think I've totally screwed up that whatever his status was. Yeah, it was very interesting.
Actually, he's schizophrenic.
Total injustice right now. So I'm sorry about that.
Well, you know, when you talk about it being a chemical imbalance, there is this doctor, and I can't remember his name, but he's in the United States. And he was a psychologist and still is a psychologist. And he, for years and years and years, had all these clients coming in who were depressed. And he was saying that he started doing a bit more study on the possible nutritional components of what role that played in the chemical imbalance.
Right.
And so the more he studied it, he started taking blood tests of these individuals to see if there were any deficiencies in things like vitamin C, vitamin B, vitamin D, whatever it was. And my goodness, he said he couldn't believe that the findings he was getting, so much so that he decided to open a clinic right next to his psychology clinic, and it was a nutrition clinic. And what happens is now that every time someone who's depressed comes into his clinic, he sends them to the nutrition clinic first. They get their blood tested. For a 1 month, he gives them supplements to bring up their B levels, their D levels, C, whatever they're lacking in. And then when they come back to him, he does a reassessment. And if they're still feeling, you know, really depressed, he then will go more chemical. Okay.
Right.
He has said that by doing it from a biological level and from a supplement level, he has had an 80% success rate in helping not necessarily cure, but level out people's depression where they don't feel depressed anymore.
I think that's amazing. I was listening to a podcast about incarceration and various programs that countries around the world have incorporated within their prisons, just, you know, pilot projects or, you know, standard projects. And one of them, I think it was a Danish prison, did a whole nutrition thing because, you know, they had a lot of fights and, you know, bad behavior within the prison. And then they changed the meals to healthy diets and less sugar. And particularly the less sugar thing switched the inmates' behavior completely. Like when we think about the impact that, you know, a high sugar diet has on kids and they start bouncing off the walls, it's kind of stands to reason that, you know, a better diet with less sugar can have the same can have a beneficial effect for guys in prison who are bouncing off the walls can result in some really bad consequences.
Oh, that's really interesting. I'd never heard about that study. That's really cool. You know, there's, and you probably heard about this one too. I love this one where they'll take inmates in a prison and they will teach them meditation.
Oh yes,
right. And my friend Paul, who lives in Vietnam now, who is a big meditator and went to a school for meditation, he said that when they had done this in a jail where he was living close to, they said that the recidivism, is that the word?
Yep.
Okay, recidivism rate, the amount of people that come back to jail after they get out, had decreased by 50%. Like,
wow.
50% of, wow, people were no longer coming back to jail after getting out because they had kept their practice of meditation. And by meditating, they had caused themselves to become calmer and more in tune and more aware with life and no longer wanting to get into fights or to steal or to do anything. And I thought, my God, it's like, I just, when I think about this, I think about how young we are as a species in general.
Yep.
You know, and I think about how, we've got so far to go, which is exciting. It's not a depressing thing. It's exciting to think about how far we've got to go. I mean, look, we're still, you know, talking about gay marriage,
mm-hmm,
right? I mean, I sometimes find that to be a laughable conversation. I'll read in the news like, oh yeah, the state of Virginia has just decided to bring the case of whether gay marriage should be allowed to in front of the courts. I'm like, are you serious? We're really talking about this?
Humans are complex. The human body alone is complex. And then adding that layer of our social interactions with each other, I mean, we have so much to learn. There is a lot of fodder for discussion and development ahead of us.
Well, I couldn't agree more. You know, it's funny. This is probably a good place for us to maybe wrap up this conversation because, well, I know that you got to go take a friend to the airport. And but you know, one thing I will say, you know, before, as we kind of take off here, is this kind of brings us full circle to where we started this original conversation, which was the importance of having powerful conversations. And this is not just a plug for this show or a plug for the work that I do, but
shameless.
Yeah, I know, right? But when it comes right down to it, the more conversations we have with our friends, our family, our coworkers, or strangers about these big subjects, the more we do grow up and the more we do find ourselves going, oh yeah, man, like I need to really think about, the food that I eat or my levels of depression or what's going on in Iraq or what's going on in Syria, or I got to think about more about gay marriage or racism or whatever the big subject of the day happens to be.
Right.
And to let powerful conversation be the mechanism that gets us there.
I totally agree. Could not agree more.
Yeah. So, well, hopefully when people listen to this, they are inspired to go out there and ask the kinds of questions that allow them to have these powerful conversations. But, you know what? This has been
fun. Or to talk to their neighbor or write a nice note.
Yes, exactly. Go say thank you or sorry. One of the two. By the end of the day. But listen, you know, I'll probably end up seeing you probably in the next few days. But thank you for doing this. This has been This has been really good. I'm going to hopefully get you back on this show again, because clearly it's almost impossible to scratch the surface when you and I are talking.
Exactly. Thank you so much. It was such an honor to be on this.
Wicked. So, well, good luck. And I'm going to hang up on you now, though, okay?
Perfect.
All right. Lots of love. Talk to you soon.
Bye.
Okay, bye.
The number you have dialed has been changed. The new number is
1-800-THE-NEW-NUMBER. Thank you for tuning in to The Stuart Knight Show. We hope you've enjoyed this powerful conversation. People are fascinating, and so are you. And the right questions will prove it.